Tickets for Elnora may be purchased online only on CranertCenter.com. Call Cranert Center at 217-333-6280 or email cran-tix, that's K-R-A-N-T-I-X, at illinois.edu for more information. And now here's today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with Tina Urich, director of the Illinois Respite Coalition. But first, disability news for the week of September 13th, 2021. Half of the 50 states report that a number of Medicaid home and community-based services providers have closed since the start of the pandemic, with many seeing many types of services close their doors. In a survey of programs in 41 states that was conducted through mid-July, 25 states reported that at least one provider had permanently closed. The findings come in a report released recently from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Adult day programs were the most likely to have closed, followed by in-home care providers, supported employment, and group homes. In 16 states, closures affected multiple types of service providers. Survey results showed that the pandemic worsened already problematic workforce shortages at group homes and for services provided in individuals' homes, but there were also impacts from people with disabilities and their families declining to allow workers into their homes due to coronavirus concerns. Many states said they used retainer payments to allow providers to continue billing for approved services during temporary closures to keep providers afloat, but that was still insufficient for some. Congress has already taken some steps to address the impact of the pandemic on disability service providers. In March, Congress approved almost $13 billion over the next year for home and community-based services as part of the American Rescue Plan. Kaiser Family Foundation report indicates that states may use the additional money to increase pay rates for providers and invest in workforce recruitment, among other things. President Biden has proposed an additional $400 billion investment for home and community-based services as part of the reconciliation package that Democrats in Congress are currently putting together, but it's still not clear what will end up in the final legislation. The state of Maryland is moving forward with allowing COVID-19 vaccine booster shots for older adults and others living in nursing homes and other group settings, even though the federal government has not yet issued formal rules for when most Americans should get them. Governor Larry Hogan announced last week that the state is immediately authorizing boosters for those age 65 and older in nursing homes, assisted living centers, residential treatment centers, and group homes for people with disabilities. The state's move expands the Food and Drug Administration's mid-August decision to allow third doses for immunocompromised individuals who have had transplants, cancer treatment, and advanced HIV or otherwise have weakened immune systems and can't fight infections. As the Delta variant renews concerns about COVID-19 across much of the country, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is taking steps to help people with intellectual and developmental disabilities understand and protect themselves against the virus by introducing a series of resources specifically aimed at them. The new resources include a toolkit with social stories, videos, posters, and interactive activities. The materials address getting a COVID-19 vaccine, wearing a mask, social distancing, hand washing, and getting a COVID-19 test. In addition, the CDC has released a tip sheet for caregivers to help them ease worries about COVID-19 and one for healthcare providers to help facilitate discussions about the virus with patients who have disabilities. Said Dr. Karen Remley, director of CDC's National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, quote, "People with intellectual and developmental disabilities can experience communication barriers that make it harder for them to understand and act on crucial health guidance. The aim of these materials is to help people with IDD, their parents, and other caregivers share critical information with their loved ones about COVID-19 and what to expect when getting a COVID-19 test or vaccine, and explain how to stay safe if they are not vaccinated," end quote. The CDC said it held discussions with adults who have intellectual and developmental disabilities and caregivers as it worked to develop the new toolkit. The materials utilize plain language, which is intended to be easy to read and to understand. While the number of reported hate crimes rose significantly in 2020, crimes aimed at people with disabilities declined, according to new data from the FBI. The agency's Uniform Crime Reporting Program shows that there were 83 incidents stemming from disability bias in 2020, down from 144 the year before. Overall reports of hate crimes actually increased by 6% last year to nearly 8,000 incidents. That's the highest number since 2008. Figures are based on statistics submitted by law enforcement agencies across the country. Hate crimes data includes information about incidents motivated by disability, as well as race, ethnicity, ancestry, religion, sexual orientation, gender, and gender identity. And those 8,000 incidents I mentioned earlier include all of those categories. The report found that 1% of hate crime victims were targeted because of their disability. Among disability-related incidents, the FBI said that 45 were considered against individuals with mental health or intellectual disabilities, while 38 were aimed at people with physical disabilities. The FBI report represents an incomplete picture of the true level of hate crimes occurring, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. They noted that fewer police agencies participated in the data collection this year than last year, in that thousands of agencies either did not supply any information or reported no hate crimes. And finally, according to new research, only 1% of television advertising includes people with disabilities, even though they account for more than a quarter of the population. Nielsen, the company best known for television ratings, analyzed the data from almost 450,000 ads that aired in primetime on broadcast stations and cable in February of 2021. Nielsen found that only 6,000 of the ads showed or referenced disabilities in themes, images, or topics, and these ads account for 3% of spending on television ads in their analysis. More than half of the ads that were inclusive of disabilities were in the category of health and personal care, mainly pharmaceutical companies. The report notes that advertisers have, quote, an opportunity to help break down social stigmas around disability by making people with disabilities more visible, end quote. Christine Mallon, who has a disability and is head of inclusive design and accessibility at the global marketing communications agency Wunderland Thompson, said that advertisers need to take a broader view. Mallon said, quote, many brands are embracing the need to engage and include people with disabilities, but when they include people with disabilities in creative content, we need to be seen for who we are beyond our disabilities without ignoring the fact that we have one, end quote. And that's the news for this week. You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I'm Vicki Nicewander. This is Disability Beat, and I'm pleased to introduce to you my guest for this week, Tina Urich, who is the director of an organization called the Illinois Respite Coalition. And I'm sure she'll tell you all about it. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Oh, thank you for having me, Vicki.
So why don't we start out by having you introduce yourself and how you ended up in this role, and then we'll talk more about the actual organization, okay?
Sure. So, again, my name is Tina Urich, and I am the director at the Illinois Respite Coalition. I was a volunteer on the board for the Illinois Respite Coalition for, I'm going to say over 10 years ago. So about a year and a half ago, we were going through some changes, and then I was asked to be the director of the program. Prior to that, I was a director of a volunteer respite program through an organization called Clearbrook, and I ran a respite program in, we had four site-based programs in four different counties, and then we also had an in-home program in three counties, and that was all utilizing volunteers.
Great. So before we get into the organization itself, it might be a good idea to define respite, because there are a lot of people who listen to this who probably understand what that terminology means, but also a number of people who are not familiar with disability lingo in general. So if you could explain it in a way that helps those folks to understand what we're talking about.
Sure. So respite, the word really just means a break. And when I'm talking to a caregiver who calls, and I still do, I get caregivers who are like, what is respite? And I'm like, you know what? It's an opportunity for you to take a break, to have a chance to take a breath, knowing that your loved one with a special needs is in caring, capable hands. And it's really important, you know, and, you know, you have a lot of caregivers like, oh, you know, I don't even know what that is. But it's, you know, studies have just really shown that, you know, respite really helps to relieve that caregiver burnout from all the emotional and physical exhaustion that can develop through the responsibilities of supporting and caring for another individual.
That's a great explanation. So now let's talk a little bit about the Illinois Respite Coalition and what it provides to families and caregivers in Illinois.
Oh, thank you. So the Illinois Respite Coalition, or IRC, it started as a grassroots organization back in 1998. And, you know, today we are a nonprofit organization, 501c3, statewide. We provide information and referral on respite services. And we do that across the lifespan. And really what that means is, no matter your age or special need, if you're in need of respite, you can call us. And then we will talk, and then we can find out and refer you to appropriate services in the area that you live, okay, you know, depending on the age and special need.
And is this limited to people with disabilities, caretakers for people with disabilities, or is it more broad than that?
Sure. So the information and referral that we do statewide is very broad. It can be, a daughter calling because she's concerned about her mother because her dad has dementia and she needs help. Mm-hmm. It can be a friend saying, my neighbor is going through chemo and she's got little kids. Is there anything that, you know, that is around to help them? So statewide, we do that. And then we are really fortunate that we received a grant from the Department of Human Services to provide in-home respite. And for that grant, that's specific. And that's a grant that provides families or provides respite to families who have a loved one with a diagnosed intellectual or developmental disability. And through that grant, we can provide caregivers a break of 180 hours a program year. So those are two things. And then the third thing is when we have funding, we have an emergency respite care grant. And that's a grant to help provide some emergency assistance, temporary emergency assistance when funded. So we're waiting to hear about funding for our emergency respite care grant.
Have you found that it's people who are financially in need that are most likely to contact you, or are a wider, more broad sample of the population in need of that respite care?
You know, I really think it's broad. You know, I mean, it's we get a lot of referrals from, you know, social workers or schools, you know, for families, especially, you know, during, you know, COVID, and some families were calling and they're like, you know, there was two of us able to help support and work through. We never thought we'd have to call you, mm-hmm. For any kind of support. You know, but we need it, whether my loved one had to leave the state to find another job or do whatever. So it's more broad. And even today, you know, you get people who call and they're like, I'm so embarrassed. I'm like, don't be, you're strong. You're calling, you're finding out, you're taking care of yourself. You're putting that oxygen on you like we all know we should, but a lot of us don't.
Yeah. So how does this work? You referred to the fact that, you know, with COVID-19, that a lot of people are struggling in their homes and not being able to take breaks from their kids. How does that apply to the Respite Coalition in that people are providing direct care for families?
Yeah. So really, you know, great question. I mean, what we did is we, you know, really make sure to follow the CDC recommendations. We have masks, we have, hand sanitizers. We made sure to be in contact with our families and our respite providers to make sure that they feel safe. And we have practices in place, too, that we ask them to do prior to, providing respite. And that's that temperature check, any type of symptoms, make sure to cancel. And when we've had a respite worker who's like, you know, I just want to let you know it's a cold, it's not COVID, don't worry. I'm like, you got to still get that COVID test and it's got to come back negative. Mm-hmm. We had some families that during that time were frankly like, you know what, this is our little bubble and we're going to make do. And we had others that were just like, you know, this is, I'm up 24 hours a day. I need to make sure that I can still get that respite. So we really tried hard to make sure that we followed policies and that both our respite providers and our families felt safe. And really, too, during that time, we've had some families who hit the pause button, but are coming back. And, you know, we were really fortunate that we didn't shut our doors. We didn't stop answering phones. And we, as long as there was that need out there, we're like, okay, we're going to try hard to still try to help you.
Yeah. And so are respite workers considered essential workers? Are they eligible for vaccine at this time?
Yes. Yes. Yes, yes, they are. And actually, too, through the Champaign Public Health Department, you know, we received an email to, we're starting to get a group together for some of the respite workers and through PACE Inc., who notified us and say, come on board, you know, we're going to get our personal support workers, get some of your respite providers together. And if they haven't gotten their vaccine, they can get it. So, yes, this is the time, you know, for them and, you know, also for the caregivers who have individuals with disabilities.
Yeah, I mean, the Champaign Public Health District has done a great job with vaccines and vaccine distribution. But still, it's really tough for people to get appointments. I just got my notification on the PACE program today. My daughter has not yet had her vaccination, so we're going to hopefully get into that that particular mode to be able to get her and her personal support workers, you know, hooked up with vaccinations as well. But it's really a worry, I know, for families that they have kids, you know, adult children even, who are very susceptible to any kind of virus or bacterial infection. So I'm sure there's a lot of concern out there for bringing, you know, essentially a stranger in the home to support them when they don't really know them so much. What kind of, you know, how do you answer that question?
So, you know, to me, the most important piece for bringing somebody into your home, you know, and I'm going to take a quick step back. Through our in-home program, family members can refer a family member to us to train and pay, as long as that family member is over 18 years of age and not living in their home. Mm-hmm. But like you mentioned, you have people who don't know anybody, and then it is somebody that they don't know. And how do you do that? Well, what we do is really concentrate on the match. So it's really important to find out what the family's needs are and what, you know, what they're really looking for. And then we will match them with a worker who we feel can really meet those needs. And we start off either by a conference call or a Zoom meeting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we start this meeting with, hey, listen, this is just an opportunity for us to get to know each other and to talk. No decisions is going to be made at this time. But I'll start with the family and say, hey, tell us about your needs. Tell us about, you know, your child. And then we give the respite provider an opportunity to ask questions. And then it's the family's time, you know, to hear about the respite provider straight from her or him. And usually from that meeting, you can kind of get a feel. But, you know, I will still say, all right, you know what? I want you both to think about it. And feel free to get back to me and let me know your thoughts. And this way I feel it takes the pressure. And it's just not like, oh, you know, Tina feels this would be a great fit, but I don't.
Yeah.
And I got to take them anyway. So really, I say to families, you have the say every step of the way. And so does the respite worker. If they feel that this is something that they can't commit to, or it's just not the right fit, then we don't start with you. If then it's not the right fit. It's not going to last. And having a revolving door isn't the answer. So I'm happy to say that it takes a little longer, but we've had really great results and matches by just making sure that we kind of take our time to find the right person.
Well, that's good news. I have one more question for you.
Sure.
When our daughter was younger, we never were able to use respite services because we had three children. And only one of them had a disability. So the agency would say to us, well, you can have respite for your one child, but we're not going to provide it. Has that changed any, or is it still essentially the same?
So that's a great, great question. So it's based on the agency. Our philosophy is we want to support the whole family. So, you know, we will tell a respite worker there's four You know, there's four children in this family, and you know those siblings can be great help. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do. So that the caregiver has that opportunity to spend some one-on-one time or not, and just, you know, have some alone time. But yes, our respite providers support the whole family.
About how many respite providers are there in the Champaign County area, roughly?
Oh, that question I didn't prepare for. That's a good question. We serve over 21 counties. So I am going to say that for our respite providers in the Champaign County, 20, maybe 25 mm-hmm. Respite providers.
Well, that's a fairly significant number. And so what's the process then? Just a phone call or an email to you guys? Is that the way it works? Or walk through that a little bit.
Sure. So it all starts with a phone call or an email to us. And for the family and the respite provider, we explain the whole process. So we let them know that eligible families receive 180 hours of program year. Mm-hmm. And we let them know that our pay is $13.70 an hour. The family has an easier process. When I call them, we do an intake, and then there is a fillable application for them to complete. And then the family has to provide proof of diagnosis. And that's just if we were ever audited by DHS, they could see that the funding went to eligible families. It's the respite providers who have more of a process. And I just come up and tell them that. I'm like, you know, I'm going to send you a new hire packet, and it's a packet for a reason. Mm-hmm. You're going to have an application in there. You're going to have two background checks. If you're not in the fingerprint database, we are going to ask you to go get fingerprinted. And, of course, we'll pay for that. There is two online trainings, and then there is all of the paperwork needed to work, and then, you know, for payroll purposes. Mm-hmm. If they are not CPR certified, then we also have a training available for that. So I can tell you motivated providers have done it in a day. But it's usually, you know, a few days before we can get everything back.
Yeah. So you're looking for families to be served and people to serve them, both ends of the spectrum.
Yes. Yes, we are. We still have openings in our grants to serve more families, and I want to get them in.
Absolutely.
And that's why I so appreciate, you know, to Vicki taking the time and this opportunity tonight. We do serve Champaign County. We have openings, and myself and our wonderful assistant program assistant Kara, we work really hard and quickly to try to get that matching, that paperwork, and get you up and running in respite so that you can start to take that break.
Great.
And that breath.
The website is?
So our website is www, and then it's full IllinoisRespiteCoalition.org.
And I'm sure if you Google Illinois Respite Coalition, you'll probably get to it as well. And the phone number.
Sure. Our phone number is 630-207-8479.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Tina. Tina Urich, Director of the Illinois Respite Coalition. Thanks so much. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of your week.
No, I'll stand my ground. Dragging me down, gonna stand my ground.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Now stay tuned for Food Sleuth Radio.